If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Line engine, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a monthly podcast alternating fortnightly with its stablemate, the Martian Drive-In Podcast. Paleo Cinema looks at movies more than 20 years old in a wide range of genres and tries to find the cool, obscure or forgotten cinema of the past and brings it to your attention. Feedback is important, so please leave reviews on iTunes, email feedback, either written or MP3 attachment, to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru with a K at gmail.com. Or if you are in the USA, you can leave voicemails on area code 206-203-3299. This podcast contains coarse language and adult concepts, so you know it's going to be good.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 103. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing a couple of musicals. Haven't done musicals for a while, so don't complain if you don't like musicals. I'm doing them anyway. And they are from 1955, a very underrated Gene Kelly MGM musical called It's Always Fair Weather, and from 1943, musical which stars all black actors and actresses and singers and dancers and musicians called Stormy Weather. So it's basically weather versus weather. So how is everybody? I'm doing really, really particularly groovy at the moment. Last weekend I went to the National Science Fiction Convention, Continuum, here in Melbourne, and caught up with a whole bunch of people, including other podcasters, which was very, very nice to do. And in fact, some friends of mine, Kirsten and Mondi, won a Ditmar Award for their podcast, The Writer and the Critic, which is very, very nice to see. And well-deserved. They are very, very good at what they do and love them like Vegemite, and I'm happy that they won. And I was also on a really good panel. Now, I usually get on a few convention panels when I go to conventions, mostly because I can string words together and I'm willing to do it. But this particular one was about podcasting. And on the panel were Alyssa Krasenstein from the Galactic Suburbia podcast, Jonathan Strawn from the Coos Street podcast, and Kirsten, who I mentioned just a moment ago, from The Writer and the Critic, who also does do some work producing another podcast, Shooting the Pooh. So all of us were up there on stage. We had an audience of podcasters and people who are interested in podcasting, and it went really, really well. We were playing off each other. Everybody got their own time to have their say. We told stories about the podcasts we do and about our audiences and how we do them. And it was just one of the best hours of convention paneling that I've experienced in a really long time. I came away from it totally buzzed on it, and everybody there is fantastic, and everybody also said that we've got to do it again. We've got to catch up at another convention and do another podcasting panel, just because it went so well and the vibe and the supportive environment was really exceptional. So, and apart from that, I did 3.5 days of hanging out with cool people. It was International Gin Day last weekend, so I sat at the bar and drank a Bombay Sapphire to celebrate International Gin Day. Caught up with the other person I caught up with. My friend Roman does a very short podcast, which I will link to, and he interviewed me for his 5 or 10 minute podcast that he does, sitting in a park on a cold winter's day, slightly damp, with trams going past and seagulls mooching food. And we talked about old movies and things like that. So, yeah, all in all, a groovy time, and really, it was really kind of life-affirming and invigorating, and kind of reminded me of all the things I love about podcasting, which is never a bad thing to have. So let's get on with the movies. I'm just going to play a track from the first of the two movies, Stormy Weather, and then talk about why I think it is worth your regard.
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, for you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love for you. Like Jack Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for. Leave me, I don't stay out.
Well,
thank you.
No place to go. I'm home about it, just me and my radio. Hey, misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
That was Thomas Fats Waller with Ain't Misbehaving from Stormy Weather. Stormy Weather is a really interesting movie for a few reasons. It's a 1943 movie distributed by 20th Century Fox. It was directed by a guy called Andrew L. Stone, who was a jobbing director. He didn't really have a long career or a particularly distinguished one, but he did the job okay and really brought a level of professionalism to it. I'll just go through a couple of Stone's movies. Let's see what he did. There's a movie from 1958 called Criteria. He did this very interesting. A few film noirs, A Blueprint for Murder. He did Secret of My Success, 1965, a really weird comedy starring James Booth and Honor Blackman, which also had giant spiders in it. A really bad musical called Song of Norway and the Great Waltz in 1972. So, like I said, he was a jobbing director, not really fantastic, but you know, he had a career from 1937 to 1972, so we can't really complain. Died at the age of 96 in 1999, so he had a pretty long career. Now, back to the movie, Stormy Weather. It stars Lena Horne, Bill Bojangles Robinson, Cab Calloway, Catherine Dunham and her dancers, Fats Waller, of course, the Nicholas brothers, Fayard and Harold, Ada Brown and Dooley Wilson, the people who people will remember from Casablanca, amongst other things. But it's basically not too different from a lot of kind of white musicals of the time. But the fact that all of those people are in it makes it a really fascinating film. The basic, I'll go through the story a little bit, though. That's not a really big part of what happens there. It takes basically, blah, 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 sorry, my mouth went all wobbly there. Bilbo Jangles Robinson is the star of the movie, ostensibly. He plays a guy called Bill Williamson, a talented dancer who returns home in 1918 after fighting in World War One, and tries to pursue a career as a performer. Along the way, he meets a beautiful singer named Selena Rogers, played by Lena Horne, and basically, it's a little bit like the life story of Bill Robinson, even though he didn't have a romance with a singer and anything like that. And Dooley Wilson plays his best friend in this, who's perpetually broke. But the movie, the plot doesn't really matter that much. It's done in flashback with Bill Robinson talking to a bunch of kids about his career and his life. And then they flash back onto 1918 and start going through what he does. But it's 77 minutes long. It's not a really long film. But dig this. 20 musical numbers in the film in 77 minutes. And they captured some of the best people doing what they do of the black performers available at the time. Fats Waller in particular, he died a couple of months after this movie was made. He was on a train and caught pneumonia and died of pneumonia on a train outside Kansas City, Missouri. Waller was a really fascinating guy, incredibly talented musician. He was very influential on people who came after him. A lot of bop musicians like Count Basie and Errol Garner cited him as one of their major influences. Something really interesting happened to him while he was performing in 1926. He was kidnapped in Chicago, leaving a performance. Four men bundled him into a car, and they took him off to the Hawthorne Inn. And you know, they put him in front of a piano and said, play. Turns out he was a surprise guest at Al Capone's birthday party. So basically, I'm reading this from Wikipedia. It's really interesting. I'm going to have to find a good biography of Fats Waller because he had a really interesting life. He was shit scared, basically, and because, you know, these four guys are bundling him in, they're taking him there, and suddenly Al Capone's in front of you. He played for 3 days. When he left the Hawthorne Inn, he was very drunk, extremely tired, and had earned thousands of dollars in cash from Capone and other partygoers as tips. So I suppose that makes things a little bit better. But of course, you know, all of his songs, Honeysuckle Rose, Ain't Misbehaving, Your Feet's Too Big is a particularly good song of his, which, you know, he's saying to a girl, I don't like you because your feet's too big. But basically, it's about racism. It's about judging people by appearances. So Waller was a very intelligent songwriter. He'd slide that stuff in, even though he did. If you have a look at the YouTube clip of him singing Honeysuckle Rose, he's mugging and playing it larger than life in there. But very intelligent guy. Very, very, very good musician. In fact, he used to do Bach organ recitals. Dig this. Jazz musician, Fats Waller, Ain't Misbehaving, did Bach organ recitals, and he actually performed them, and there are a few audio recordings of it as well. So he really knew his classical music. He also knew jazz really well. Unfortunately, he did die fairly early. You got to remember, 1943, antibiotics were still fairly new. They'd only just been introduced into the theatre in World War II, and they weren't necessarily available in normal hospitals. So if somebody comes in with pneumonia, you treat it topically, and you treat the symptoms and hope that they survive it. So when you see, particularly any time before World War II, when people died of pneumonia and septicemia and other things, it's because antibiotics weren't available then. And they could well have saved Fats Waller's life. He died at the age of, he said, rustling pages very unprofessionally, at the age of 39. So wasn't old at all. He could have well have lived into the 60s and 70s and really contributed to music. And otherwise, can you imagine him on an episode of Laugh-In or something like that? It's just such a loss that Fats Waller died. Bill Robinson, again, another interesting guy. He was, at the time the movie was made, he was in his early 60s. So him being the love interest of Lena Horne, who at the time, he said, rustling pages again because he hasn't done his research very well. She was born in 1917, so at the time this movie was made, she was in her early 20s. So you've got a guy in his early 60s as a love interest of a woman in her early 20s. So basically, early mid-20s, let's say. So basically, they did underplayed the love interest thing, and it's almost played like they were good friends, because I think both actors were kind of slightly embarrassed by that age discrepancy. If you complain about Bruce Willis with young chicks in movies now, that predates that by a considerable margin. Of course, people also remember Bill Robinson from doing Dancing with the Shirley Temple in movies in the 1930s. So he had a long career. He was actually born in 1878. So he, let's have a look here. He was a hoofer and a busker at local beer gardens, dropped out of school. He joined a kind of minstrel troupe in 1886. So incredibly long career. And not until he was 50 years old, dig this, not until he was 50 years old, did he dance for wide audiences. So all of his career up until the early 1930s had been purely within the realm of black theatre and vaudeville, dancing, busking, all that kind of stuff. So really, must be really a head spin to suddenly be doing high-budget Shirley Temple movies at that age. He did serve, as the story in Stormy Weather alludes to, he did serve as a rifleman in World War One. He was in New York's 15th Infantry Regiment of the National Guard, and they were known as the Harlem Hellfighters. So they served in the trenches in World War One. So you know, he definitely, it's a sort of slightly diminished biography of Bill Robinson, this movie, but really, I don't think it does his justice. I think an HBO miniseries of his life would be something that I would really enjoy seeing. And you've got, of course, you've got Lena Horne in the movie, one of the first black actors and singers to kind of break through that color barrier in cinema. Even though they never really took advantage of the fact that she was a very intelligent and sensual singer and dancer, they kind of, as they did with the male sexuality of black actors at the time, they kind of diminished that sexiness that Lena Horne could put across. They always had her as a feature act in musical movies, so she wasn't interacting with the white characters in the mainstream movies. But in this one, she's very much a part of things. And as she was in Cabin in the Sky and a couple of other movies like that, which had a predominantly black cast, they cut out a bubble bath scene for her in Cabin in the Sky, singing a song called Ain't It the Truth, because it was considered too risque by film executives, which strikes me as really amusing, because if anybody looks into the history of film executives in the 1940s, they weren't shy little flowers by any means. They were definitely full-blooded guys, and I suppose they may have been aware of the hypocrisy of what they're doing, but it was all about the dollar at that stage, as indeed it is in movies now. People make stupid decisions based on what they think is going to make them X amount of more money. And if you have a look through even recent disasters in movies, naming John Carter, for instance, it was all about a perception that executives have about what audiences want. And of course, again, it shows that they were wrong. Like William Goldman said, nobody knows anything. They guess, sometimes they guess lucky, but when it comes down to this stuff, nobody really knows anything when it comes to making movies. But Lena Horne, fantastic voice, beautiful woman. I had never seen her in a really dramatic role acting, but it would have been nice if she'd been given the same kind of opportunities. But the real feature piece of Stormy Weather is the last bit with Cab Calloway and his band. Cab Calloway, another interesting guy too. He was born in 1907 in New York. And people remember him best, of course, from the Blues Brothers, where he did Heidi, 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 Heidi kind of stuff. But in Stormy Weather, he's there in his full kind of zoot suit with the great big pocket chain and the enormous hat and the padded shoulders and the whole works. doing a song. And the music kind of keeps going, and they cut in the Nicholas Brothers doing a dance number, which is mind-blowingly good. Fred Astaire said that it was the best piece of dancing on film that he had ever seen. The Nicholas Brothers dancing on drums, dancing around the stage, doing some fantastic scenes where they're doing the splits down a flight of stairs, jumping over each other and then doing the splits. It's just an incredible piece of athleticism apart from anything else, and a really showcase for the Nicholas Brothers, who went on to have long careers. They did things like they went entertaining the troops in the 1960s in Vietnam with Bob Hope, for instance. So they had a long career in nightclubs and Las Vegas and places like that. A little bit of a disagreement between the brothers at various times, but in this movie, just watching them do that one incredible dance number is mind-blowingly good. It's one of those things that really makes you wish that people had been more enlightened about race in those days, so we could have got more of the Nicholas Brothers on film dancing. It's mind-blowingly spectacular. I'm going to post the YouTube clip of that up on the website, paleo-cinema.com, just so people can really enjoy that, because really simply it doesn't get any better than that when it comes to dance in movies. It would have been great if this film was done in colour, boom, but it was in black and white. It is available around. I picked my copy up for people here in Australia in JB Hi-Fi. So there are releases on DVD. No bells and whistles. It's not a particularly that kind of movie where people will add all the extras, even though it would have been great if they had. But I like it. It's short, it's punchy, and it's a showcase for some incredible talents who, because of the colour of their skin, didn't get the opportunities to really have powerful careers in Hollywood, even though their talents were mind-blowingly good. They were just awesome. They're as good as anybody else who was doing movies for MGM or any of the other studios that did really big musicals and things like that. The talents and the beauty and the grace and the artistry of the people in Stormy Weather really does kind of make I love the joyousness of it. I love the whole seeing things I hadn't seen before and artists I hadn't seen much of before. But it's also kind of tainted with a sadness that they didn't get more opportunity to reap the rewards of their skills in that sense. Check the movie out. It's worth seeing. It's a really, really good print on the one that I caught. And just ending on that high note of the Nicholas Brothers dance sequence, which was the right thing to do in the movie. Really, you wouldn't have anything that would top that further into the film. It's just a joy to watch if you appreciate dance at all. Just going to play us out with a little bit of Bill Robinson. He's on a riverboat heading down to New Orleans to start his career after the war. And a little bit of the dance and the music that's playing in the background. I don't know who the band is in the background, but really cool stuff. And and this is a word that's overused, authentic.
What's that?
Must be them traveling minstrel boys got on in New Orleans.
Boy, have you seen Smith Brown? She's the finest gal in town. Turns all Memphis upside down.
Yeah, man, yeah, man.
She's the dark-eyed Dick's queen. Boy, she got it mean. Strutest gal I ever seen.
Yeah, man, yeah, man.
Now, you should see her when she gets going. Remind you of the Mississippi flow.
Are you, dog?
Thank you, boys. It's hot enough.
Yes, of course, it's hot enough.
Well, come on, boys. Let's play the stuff.
Yeah, man, yeah, man. You can't do no skip out the
court. Yes, I can't do no skip out the court.
Yeah, man, yeah, man.
Thank you.
can take a chorus too.
Some shuffling too.
Look out, man! What you going to do?
Look out, boys! It's coming through.
Yeah, man! Yeah, man!
Boy, he got educated feet.
Boy, I practice all the time. Here's one I set up all night trying to do. Get this.
When the boat dock is Memphis, you should get yourself a job in one of the Beale Street cafes.
Boy, you've been reading my mind. Watch me go to Beale Street.
Something big is coming up. This is Terry Frost, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, The Martian Drive-In. In the podcast, me and a guest will look at obscure but interesting speculative fiction movies, the ones that don't get enough love, the obscure movies that you catch late at night you can't remember the name of, but you really like them. You can go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com or subscribe to the Paleo Cinema feed in iTunes. The Martian Drive-In Podcast. Watching the skies since 2012. Yep, that's the new promo for the Martian Drive-In Podcast. I just thought I'd throw it up there. I've emailed it to a few other podcasters, so we'll see if it gets any love based on that. On to the second movie, It's Always Fair Weather. In some ways, much more interesting and much more influential than Stormy Weather, but really a lot of fun, and it's one of the few MGM musicals that doesn't get a lot of love. It's a bit unusual in that it's not optimistic and upbeat all the time. It doesn't have that kind of gosh, wow, let's put on a show kind of vibe that a lot of MGM musicals had. In fact, when it was released, the studio released it on a drive-in double bill with Bad Day of Black Rock. Both excellent films in their own way, but I can't really see anything linking It's Always Fair Weather with Bad Day of Black Rock. That's the kind of shit the studios do. We're just going to have to accept the fact that they are functionally somewhere around the moronic level. Betty Comden and Adolf Green, who wrote On the Town, you remember On the Town is a big musical with Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra and Jules Munchen in it. Yeah, that one. Anyway, they wanted to make a sequel. They wanted to do it as a stage show and get back Frank Sinatra, Gene Kelly, and Jules Munchen. Gene Kelly was living in Europe at the time. He'd done American in Paris and Invitation to the Dance in Europe. He wanted to stay there because there were tax advantages for resident Americans. But those movies weren't that successful, and they revoked the tax law, so Gene Kelly came back to America. They threw the idea at him of doing a sequel to On the Town, and he decided that he didn't want to do it as a stage thing. He wanted to make it a musical with MGM for film. So he wanted an old friend of his, Dan Lee Donnan, who had worked with him previously and had just done Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Donnan and Kelly, yeah, the friendship was a little bit strained at the time, so they went to MGM. MGM said yes. They had a new production chief, Dor Sherry, And he didn't want to work with Sinatra or Munchen. Sinatra was notoriously difficult at that stage. A couple of years before he won an Oscar, really didn't want to. He was hard to work with. And Jules Munchen wasn't popular with audiences anymore. So they decided to go with two other actors. They went with Dan Daly, who was a hoofer and had done a few musicals, and Michael Kidd, who had been the choreographer for Seven Brothers. It's really the only film work he did was in this movie. And they came up with a story, and the story wasn't optimistic, bright, fluffy the way that a lot of other MGM musicals at the time. This is towards the end of the MGM musical heyday, but it wasn't really optimistic. I'll just let you know what the plot of the film is, and this will kind of give you a little bit of an idea about what I mean. Three ex-GIs who served together in World War II and become best friends. Upon returning home at the end of the war, they spent their last night together drinking in a favourite New York bar and exchanging their hopes and plans for the future. Before going their separate ways, they promised to reunite exactly 10 years later at the same spot. However, when the three men eventually meet up again 10 years later, they soon realize that they've steadily grown apart in the intervening years and are now very different people. Ted, the character played by Gene Kelly, is a down-on-his-luck boxing promoter. Doug, Dan Daly's character, is a stuffed shirt advertising man with an ulcer. And Angie, the Michael Kidd character, runs a small hamburger stand. Each man is forced to face the fact that, to some extent, his present life falls short of how he had imagined it would turn out when he was a younger man. Circumstances reunite them when Ted falls for a beautiful woman, Jackie, played by Sid Charisse, who, behind his back, arranges for the three soldiers to appear together on a popular television program. That's from Wikipedia, and it's one of the best little praises that I've seen on Wikipedia. So that's the situation. It's about disillusionment and not fulfilling the potential of your life. And that it's not an optimistic kind of a musical. And, of course, Gene Kelly had been working in Europe and, of course, particularly in France. And French film at the time was a lot more grown up than American cinema because of the production code and censorship and House Un-American activities and all those other pieces of roadblock that were put in the way of quality cinema. The American cinema was dumbed down for a long time. Kelly decided with, of course, Betty Comden, Adolph Green and Stanley Donen that they'd do something a little more grown up, which is about that, you know, meeting up with old friends and then realising you're not quite where you wanted to be when you are. And it's a really good idea for a movie. Stanley Donen himself said it would make a much better film without the music in it, and you can argue that point. But because they did make it a musical, it became very influential as well. It really was, some people say it was influential on the works of Stephen Sondheim, particularly Follies and Company in the 60s and 70s. It really sort of gave people the idea that musicals could be taken seriously. And, of course, Gene Kelly himself had started on stage in his first breakout role on stage just before he went to Hollywood, was playing Pal Joey in Pal Joey, the original stage production of that. So he had that grounding in kind of more serious works. And the stage version of Pal Joey is much darker than the movie version we saw in the late 1950s with Frank Sinatra and Kim Novak and Rita Hayworth. Very much a darker thing, and the Joey character was much more of a bastard. So they decided to put this movie together, and I like it. They do satire in the movie as well. There's a tremendous satire on kind of vapid women's television of the 1950s with a character called Madeline, who has a TV show called Midnight with Madeline, played by Dolores Gray. Dolores Gray was a big star on Broadway at the time, and she'd also played La Loom in the second movie version of Kismet, the MGM musical with Howard Keel in it. She played the wazir's wife and really blew people away for doing that. And in this movie too, she kind of is over the top and really a kind of almost drag queen proportion parody of a female. I'll just play a little bit of her as Madeline, just to give you an idea of the kind of smarmy rubbish that she puts across in this TV show.
Yes, Yes, it's 11 o'clock, and the makers of Cleanse Right, Dose Right, Is Right, and Was Right, also manufacturers of H2O Cola, that effervescent cola that's pure as water, as non-fattening as water, but oh boy, that cola taste that zooms you up to the skies, presents Midnight with Madeline, starring...
Me! May I come in? And now, you dear ladies and gentlemen, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to sing you a song. It's my latest recording, and I do hope you just love it. But even if you don't, I don't really mind, as long as you love me.
Yeah, so Dolores Gray does a couple of songs in this one, one of which is called Thanks a Lot But No Thanks, and the other one is Music is Better Than Words, which, interestingly enough, was covered recently in a gig that Seth MacFarlane did. He did a cover version of Music is Better Than Words, which is quite good. I really like it. But interesting to see a connection between this movie and Family Guy. So you've got Cicherice, fantastic dancer. Any singing she did, her voice was dubbed. You've got Gene Kelly and Michael Kidd, both fantastic dancers. Dan Daly, good hoofer and singer, put together in this very, very unusual musical. And there are some fantastic dance numbers in there. There's the famous dance number where Gene Kelly has an epiphany and dances on roller skates through the streets of New York. Of course, it's done on a studio. But beautifully athletic stuff, and he does some interesting things while on roller skates. A lot of fun. It's just one of those joyous little pieces of dance, kind of, you know, not in the same way as I spoke earlier of the Nicholas Brothers, but just a lot of fun and a lot of expertise, and I'm amazed that he could do it. And there's also a really good dance sequence with Gene Kelly, Dan Daly and Michael Kidd, where they do a dance with garbage can lids on one of their feet. So I'm not sure where that came from, but they do it very, very well. And of course, there are a whole bunch of subplots. Gene Kelly's character is a boxing promoter, and he's got an up-and-coming boxer. He realizes that the fix is in on the boxing, and the gangster who arranges the fix, played by a character actor called J.C. Flippin, finds out that Gene Kelly isn't interested in that. Gene Kelly knocks out his own prize fighter to stop him from going into a rigged prize fight. And it all kind of ends in a great big punch-up on stage during the production of the television show. But the heart of the movie is the kind of relationship between these three guys, and each one of them changes. Well, less so with the Michael Kidd character. He kind of stays constant. He's a small-town guy who runs a hamburger joint with his wife. He's got no pretensions. There's some implication that his name's Angelo, so you've got to assume that he's from an Italian background. And he kind of stays constant, but Gene Kelly's character kind of realizes that he's not living up to his potential. He's not the sort of person he wants to be, and he moves on from that. And of course, the relationship with Jackie, the person played by Sid Charisse, helps us along. She's a producer for Madeline's TV show. And Dan Daly's character comes to the realization he wanted to be an artist, go to Paris, be an artist, that kind of thing, and ended up doing PR work and basically buying into the corporate bullshit of the time. And there's a good scene where he kind of has his rather drunken epiphany about not wanting to be a corporate wanker anymore. And he talks to his wife by phone. They live in Chicago. And you never get to hear her, but you kind of realize that they were drifting apart because he wasn't living up to his potential. And they kind of have a meeting of the minds on that too. So it's a little bit deeper than your usual musical is, because it does talk about disillusionment and cynicism, and how sometimes by tiny increments, people can lose their way. And I kind of like that in this film. I do think it's much deeper than a lot of other musicals at the time, and it does have that start of a form of more realistic musical. Of course, there are other musicals, particularly on stage, that did that. And a few years later, around the same time, really, South Pacific was addressing issues of racism and things like that in the musical form. So even though that kind of did I mean, I saw South Pacific on Blu-ray about 2 weeks ago, and it does have a lot of flaws in it. It kind of errs on the side of cuteness in a lot of cases, but it does have that kind of underlying thread of implicit racism, which is kind of an interesting thing to approach in a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. The movie version sucks for a couple of reasons, one of which is they use some very heavy colour filters in South Pacific when song numbers came up. Apparently, they weren't going to make filters that strong, the colour filters, but the studio fucked it up, and the release date was coming quickly, and they didn't get time to fix it. There's supposed to be just a subtle colour shift at the time of the music numbers in South Pacific, but I'm digressing a little bit. What I'm saying about this film is, by the way, the music by Andre Previn, for the lyrics by Betty Comden and Alf Green, is really good as well. It becomes a, particularly in the scenes with Madeline, it plays to the satire very well. I'm going to play a little bit of one of the songs from It's Always Fair Weather called Once Upon a Time, just to give you a bit of an idea about that cynicism that I was talking about, and that kind of disillusionment with self that really makes this a bit of an unusual one.
Once upon a time, I had two friends.
Once upon a time, I thought that friendship never ends. What a joke. Gone is that dream up in smoke.
Okay, I misspoke before. I played all of the song for a start, but also it wasn't Stanley Donen who said that the movie would have worked better as a non-musical. It was Andre Previn who did the music for it, so I misspoke on that. But it was the last big bunch of dance numbers that Gene Kelly did in his career, particularly the roller skating scene when he was singing I Like Myself. The last really impressive set piece dance number of Gene Kelly's career. Of course, he appeared in another musical that I've talked about on Paleo Cinema earlier, The Young Girls of Rochefort, the kind of not quite sequel to The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. So, I think it's a nice way to cap off that kind of part of Gene Kelly's career as well. It's a technically challenging piece of dance on the roller skates. It's lovely, it's joyous, it really adds to the story, which is an unusual thing in some musical numbers. They're kind of just put in there as kind of intermissions in the narrative. But this one really does add something. In fact, all of the songs in this movie add something to the narrative. Either they're the satirical bits that the character Madeline does on her TV show, where it's satirizing the emptiness of television as it was then. And if you thought television's emptiness was a new thing, no, it wasn't. It was there for right from the start. But and the other songs in there really enhance character. Even, you know, Baby You Knock Me Out, where Sid Charisse is dancing with a whole bunch of boxes in a gymnasium, kind of gives you an idea about her character. She plays a very intelligent woman, a woman working in men's area in television. She meets the men on her own terms and gets on really well with a whole bunch of pug ugly boxes. So you can kind of understand why Gene Kelly is so attracted to her, apart from the fact that she looks like Sid Charisse. So, yeah, the songs work to enhance story, which is something that stage musicals did a lot more than Hollywood musicals at that time. But I really do like this one. I think it's well worth people thinking about more fondly than they did at the time it was made. People were expecting something totally different from an MGM musical at the time, but in retrospect, its reputation has been enormously enhanced by the fact that it did try something new and did try to be deeper than it was. So that's about it for the musicals, Stormy Weather and It's Always Fair Weather. Check them out. They're worth doing. I know that here in Australia, It's Always Fair Weather turns up regularly on TCM on cable, so it's really not too hard to find. The DVD is available in the US as well, because I picked up my DVD copy of it, which unfortunately I lent somebody. I will get it back next weekend, but I lent it to them saying, here's a musical you might like, you non-musical loving fucker. So check it out. It really is a lot of fun. In fact, Dan Daly and Sid Charisse did work together another time. A year after It's Always Fair Weather, they did a movie musical, which does turn up on TCM as well, called Meet Me in Las Vegas, which is much less a work, but it's got some interesting supporting characters in it. Agnes Moorhead's in it. Jim Backus is in it. George Chakiris is in it. And Pete Rugolo, who was one of the great kind of Las Vegas arrangers and did a number of albums. He did some stuff with the Four Freshmen, particularly. He's in there playing a conductor, and his music's in there as well. So, the more you dive into musicals, you can kind of dodge the light and the fluff, if you like. And there are a number of musicals I don't like because they don't have anything below the surface. But this one, exception that proves the rule. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to do the feedback and wind this puppy up.
Feeling so unlike myself, always used to dislike myself.
Thanks for losing your mind, and thanks for Fort Knox sealed and signed. But I've got a guy who's Clifton Webb and Marlon Brando combined.
Okay, got one piece of feedback this time around, and it's from our old friend Vince over at the B Movie Cast. And I recommend people go and subscribe to the B Movie Cast. They always do good films. They've got a great ensemble, good community going, and it's one of the podcasts that I never miss.
Hey, Terry, this is Vince from South Carolina. Just thought I'd give you a quick call, try out your new call-in number. And also to congratulate you on the Martian Drive-In. It's really cool, really digging those shows. I have the power in the first Men on the Moon. Haven't got around to watching them yet. I've had the power for quite some time. Got the Warner Archive version of it. And the two you did, Triangle and Privilege, haven't seen them yet, but they look real good. So thanks for some new ideas. And I'm just taking a short break from watching They Saved Hitler's Brain. And you know, you can't watch those kind of movies in one sitting because I think it'll cause permanent brain damage. So I'm going to take a little bit of a break and then get back to it. So just keep up the good work on both the podcasts, man. We're still out here listening. Ciao.
Yeah, thanks for that, Vince. And I believe you guys are doing Soylent Green this time around over at your podcast. So what I recommend is that people listening to that podcast, the only thing you could possibly eat would be pork crackling with green food colouring put onto it. But that's about it for this time around. It's a shorter podcast. I do apologise for that. But Continuum really sucked up all of my energy and my creative juices for a little bit. But I promise the next Paleo Cinema is going to be bigger than Ben-Hur. I may even do Ben-Hur, who knows. But in the meantime, I'm going to let you know what I'm doing on the radio gig, which can be streamed online Thursday nights, a bit after 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Time from ABC Local Radio in Darwin. Next movie we're doing is Rafifi, which I've talked about on the podcast very early on. And after that, we're doing a very interesting film that was filmed in Australia with an English star and a Canadian director, which is 1970s Wake in Fright, a very dark look at life in the Australian outback. So I'm looking forward to doing those two. They're both very challenging in their own ways and a little bit deeper than fluff. Just remember, in 2 weeks' time, we've got number three of the Martian Drive-In podcast coming up. I've got a couple of guests coming in. And the movies that we're going to do are a movie from only a couple of years ago called The Man from Earth. And we're also doing a movie from about 2002, Vincenzo Natale's Cypher. So a couple of recent science fiction-y movies. And that should be a lot of fun because they're both kind of off people's radar a little bit. They're not particularly big films, but both of them do have a few talking points of interest. So in the meantime, enjoy your movie watching, and I will be back to chat further in 2 weeks' time with the third of the Martian Drive-In podcasts. Thank you.